May it please the court. I'm Ken Chakas, and I'm honored to be here on behalf of my client, Bishop and Associates. Mr. Bishop and his wife are here with their children because they believe this is an important case not only for themselves, but for the people of Missouri. It involves the public policy of the state of Missouri. The facts of this case provide an excellent example of the kind of independent contractor that needs protection in order to protect the public policy of Missouri. Bishop and Associates is a small, family-owned plumbing company doing business for a giant Fortune 500 company. So there's no question about the quality of bargaining power here. Mr. Bishop is a second-generation plumber. He was the one providing substantially all of the services himself to Ameren. He's very well trained and experienced, took his job very seriously and cared about his work and cared about his client Ameren. He had the expertise that was lacking inside of Ameren. Ameren didn't have any licensed plumbers in its employment. So Mr. Bishop was in a position to be able to find problems in the areas in which he was working, which are central to the business of Ameren. Ameren's business is providing electrical and gas services, and in order to do that, they have to maintain the trucks that have to go out and serve their facilities. They have to maintain the buildings that everybody operates in to control the delivery of electricity. Ameren didn't dispute in its motion for summary judgment that Mr. Bishop's reports of serious misconduct to the highest levels of the company were a reason for Bishop and Associates' termination. The main legal issue here, as you know, is on count one, is whether an independent contractor should be excluded from the protection. Should we make an exception for independent contractors? Public policy is the principle that has to guide us here. Public policy is the principle that holds that no one can lawfully do that which tends to be injurious to the public or against the public good. In this case, we have a person who discovered illegal and dangerous conditions in the course of his work. He reported those conditions as his work went along, which wasn't a problem in the first years of his long relationship with Ameren. But as budget priorities took precedence over protecting the public from the things that Mr. Bishop was complaining about, it became significant.
And who was this reporting to?
Initially, he was reporting to the managers who were running the business, the building services department. But as they were resisting, he took his complaints up the line. They got to the CEO of the company. He dealt directly with three managers, including a vice president in the environmental services department.
Well, did they resist repairing things that he had repaired, or did they just resist him doing it?
They resisted getting the repairs done. There are things that he reported that were still not repaired when he left the employment. When the managers internally discussed the reports after Mr. Bishop went to the people in the environmental department and pointed out the problems that he had been complaining about, some of which were still ongoing, there are internal discussions that show we still have problems at the Dorset facility, at the Belleville facility. We haven't figured them all out. One of the most important concerns that he raised was a cross-connection between the fecal waste, drinking water. No, it was.
He there reminded, was a current one
there
also.
There was one still pending in 2010, and to his knowledge, as when he left, that had not been repaired.
And are you saying this internal reporting is in essence whistleblowing?
It is. It is whistleblowing. Definition of whistleblowing.
Do you have any authority that states intra-company reporting is whistleblowing?
Well, he wasn't an employee of the company, but even as an employee of the company, that's what all the whistleblower employment cases hold, that people who are employed reporting whistleblowing to their superiors report serious misconduct to their supervisors. I better slow down.
But reporting, part of his job, even if we're an employee, if I understand it, his job was to repair problems. So reporting their problems doesn't seem like whistleblowing. It seems like reporting a failure to correct problems might be whistleblowing, but not doing what he was hired to do,
which was both. During the first years of his employment, when he had a good relationship with the managers. And so he would point out the problems, and they would often appreciate it and get the things fixed. But as time went on, managers changed and attitudes changed, and budgets took priority over fixing things that he was reporting. Yeah. And so they were telling him to stop reporting these things to us.
In this case, does the record reflect that there wasn't any reporting to any governmental official who could do anything about it until after the contract was terminated?
That's correct. But we have reporting inside the company, which under Fleshner and all of the Supreme Court cases that deal with this and the Court of Appeals decision that set up the public policy exception for the employees, reporting within the company is one of the ways that people get protection.
And the opposing counsel says that there are no cases on all fours with this which have found a duty for independent contractors or have applied whistleblower theories to independent contractors, and they distinguish the cases that you cite.
They do. I think they're splitting hairs. The trend in this country is recognized by a 2014 article published by the ABA is to provide more and more protection of whistleblowers who are not typical employees but are often independent contractors. The cases that Mr. Haar distinguishes are those that come under statutes or cases that aren't quite independent contractors. There are some cases from New Hampshire and New Jersey where doctors complain to the HMOs on which they serve about the practices of the HMOs. Those courts saying, well, they're clearly not employees of the HMOs, they may not be independent contractors, but the distinction doesn't matter. And so those people are entitled to protection.
One of the briefs says that federal discrimination laws, including Title VII and the Americans with Disabilities Act and so forth, do not extend to independent contractors. Is that correct?
They may not, yes. There's some question about the Missouri Human Rights Act. The Howard decision does set up a way of determining whether an independent contractor could be covered by the Missouri Human Rights Act. But those statutes are designed to protect employees. In the one scholarly article about this matter by Lisa Burns that cited from the Yale Public Policy Law Review, she says that the courts that have rejected the common law extension of public policy whistleblower protection to independent contractors have really not studied the reasons for their decision, but just said they're independent contractors, so they're not covered. But she says, look at what the law, the public policy that's being talked about is designed to do. Is it designed to protect employees like Title VII, or is it designed to protect the public? And here we have complaints and whistleblowing in violation of laws that are designed to protect the public. Missouri statutes create plumbing codes and require work of plumbers to be done by licensed plumbers. The environmental laws, federal and state clean water laws, prevent the pollution with oil. There are clear statements of public policy that are at stake here, and if we don't protect independent contractors, then companies will continue to violate these laws, and the public is going to be at risk.
You make an alternative claim for a violation of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Right. Is that solely brought in regard to the termination, or also in regard to the performance of his work as an independent contractor?
That's another attack at the termination. And the law is very similar because the duty of good faith and fair dealing incorporates public policy. And even where a contract has some express terms that allow an action to be done. The public policy doctrine says that no one can lawfully do that which would be injurious to the public. So public policy trumps, I hate to use that word today, but public policy prevails over the expectations of the parties in their contractual relationship. That's the doctrine that we're dealing with today. And so the breach of contract claim is just another way of dealing with the same problem. Whether we would present both to a jury, I'm not sure, but I think there are two legal means to the same end of protecting a party to a contractual relationship from being retaliated against for.
What would the causation be on the jury instruction then?
The causation in the tort claim of wrongful discharge in violation of public policy would be whether the reports were a contributing factor in the decision. That's what this court said in the cases before it, the Fleschner case, for example, and in the, I'm not sure the Covini case said the same thing, but the Covini case is important.
So in your view, the cause or contribute to cause jury instruction would even apply to an internal reporting. Assume for sake of argument that your client never reported this to anybody outside the company. You still think that you'd be entitled to your cause of action and the jury instruction of cause or contribute to cause.
The cases in Missouri, in this court, and in the courts of appeals are clear that internal reporting is entitled to the same protection as external reporting. There's an or when they talk about what's necessary in order to have a cause of action for violation of public policy. I see my 12 minutes are up.
So thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Hope to see you again.
May it please the court. In July 2010, Ameren exercised a right that businesses, property owners, individuals have always had under the common law, and that's to tell an independent contractor, we're not going to use your services in the future. There's no dispute that Ameren had no legal obligation to use BNA. The relationship was defined by a purchase order, which simply specified the rates for labor and equipment that would be paid if Ameren chose to use BNA on a particular job. And it specified that it's non-exclusive, Ameren can use other plumbers, and there's no guarantee of any minimum quantity of work. There's also no classification issue in this case. There is no dispute that BNA was an independent contractor. What you're being asked to do here in recognizing a common law, wrongful discharge, public policy cause of action for independent contractors is something, to my knowledge, the court's never done before. And that is to create a common law cause of action that has been rejected by every other jurisdiction in the country to consider. We cite in our brief at least 20 jurisdictions, and that list is not exhaustive. You know, when this court in 2010 had the trilogy of cases extending the wrongful discharge action in the context of the employment at will doctrine, it noted in Margiotta that the right to terminate a commercial relationship is rooted in freedom of contract, which is also part of the public policy of the state, and in private property principles that have promoted efficiency for generations over a broad range of industries.
But we also say that for employees, Missouri is an at-will employment state, and the right of the employer to terminate an employee at will is absolute unless it's a violation of public policy.
That's right.
And it's not. And they say the exact same thing applies to an independent contractor for the same reasons.
And there are distinctions, pointed distinctions, between employees and independent contractors. But what the court said in those cases is, we are going to recognize a very, very narrow exception to the employment at will doctrine and limited it to the employer-employee relationship, an emphasis this court again made in Farrow in 2013. What they're asking for is a sweeping, unprecedented restriction on the right of independent entities and individuals to terminate a commercial relationship along the whole range of potential commercial relationships.
Opposing counsel says that would allow large corporations to take advantage of small independent contractors who, as a practical matter, as opposed to a theoretical matter, don't have any greater ability to protect themselves than do employees. Are there other protections in place in that situation?
Your Honor, virtually all the protections in the United States for independent contractors are statutory. And there's a reason for that. As I said, there's no precedent for this cause of action. It's not supported by your cases. But the other reason why these are dealt with on a statutory basis is because they involve policy choices. And policy choices that also vary from industry to industry. What they're talking about is fundamentally altering the law of contracts in the state. When we argued this in front of the Court of Appeals, there was a lot of discussion, well, what does this mean for law firms? What does it mean for accounting firms? What does it mean for material suppliers? The whole range of contexts in which this might arise, which this court, no one, can reasonably anticipate. The other thing that was pointed out is because of the differences between independent contractors and employees, this cause of action is particularly susceptible to abuse. I think that's actually illustrated by the facts of this case. And that means that it can be counterproductive, that what you're doing is deterring people from retaining independent contractors to correct problems. When we talk about this difference between, when this court addressed the employee in the context of the wrongful discharge cause of action, and this is true for jurisdictions throughout the country, it did focus on the disparity of bargaining power. And courts that have considered this same argument in the context of independent contractors have emphasized there's not the same disparity of bargaining power. B&A is a standalone for-profit corporation with its own employees, its own equipment, its own vehicles. It can choose its customers. It can add customers. It can move away from a customer if there's a disagreement about how they do their work or other aspects of the relationship. We hear in this case about the fact that, well, B&A did a majority of its work for Ameren. That was B&A's choice. The evidence in the record was that when B&A had an opportunity to do more work for Ameren, rather than expand, it decided what it would do was drop other customers who Mr. Bishop described as slow pay or with whom they had disputes about work or about invoices. Well, that's a decision that they made. It's a business risk they took.
Do we run the risk, if we agree with your argument, of encouraging companies to farm out parts of their business that are not performed by employees to independent contractors so they can avoid these public policy exceptions?
No, Your Honor, because if, in fact, someone is functioning as an employee, you already have the law in place in Howard and other common law doctrines to determine whether or not someone who's been classified as an independent contractor is in fact an employee. And therefore, they would be provided with protections under the cases from Fleshner through Farrow. That's not an issue here. There's no classification issues here. And in terms of what distinguishes an employee from an independent contractor is this freedom to move to other customers, and it's not dependent on how you choose to exercise that freedom. Now, the other really critical distinction between independent contractors and employees is the financial incentives, and I think this is very important. Employees normally receive a salary or an hourly wage. Traditional independent contractors like B&A are paid on a job-by-job basis based on the scope of the work of that particular job. And as a result, they have an incentive the employee does not have to increase the number of jobs and to increase the scope of the work. And as the Court of Appeals pointed out, that created a unique potential for abuse in the context of independent contractors, because what you risk is providing independent contractors with what the court called a uniquely exploitive tool for expanding the scope of work by pointing out real or purported violations and then threatening to report them unless the owner agrees to authorize the contractor to fix it. Now, in their reply brief, B&A says, well, that's not a problem. I mean, yeah, there's this incentive to expand the number of jobs, and there's this incentive to expand the scope of work, but who's going to pay the contractor money for work that is unnecessary? Look at the tortious interference, or look at the tortious interference count in this case. B&A has sued three individual supervisors for allegedly tortiously interfering with B&A's contract for Ameren. And the gravamen of the complaint is they talked amongst themselves about B&A being expensive, using unnecessary equipment, expanding the scope of the job beyond what was necessary. And that's the problem here. This is part of the policy choice. This is part of the policy calculus. Public policy isn't this narrow view they're talking about. Are you creating a cause of action that would be unique in the country that's going to be counterproductive? Because what it's going to do is deter businesses from hiring independent contractors to fix a problem because of concerns that it could result in regulatory complaints or even a lawsuit if they attempt to exert the control an owner normally has to determine the scope of the work, the scope of what they're going to pay for, or if they decide to use a different contractor, either on this job or on the next job. And it's the potential for deterring the very type of corrections that you're trying to promote that is part of the public policy calculations and part of the reason why in other jurisdictions they have concluded, you know, the choice is here. Once we get beyond employment, these are really determinations to be made by the legislature. They're policy choices to be made by a state legislature or by Congress. And in fact, there are a myriad of these types of statutes out there that were specifically crafted to deal with a particular problem in a particular industry. Some just go to employees, some include independent contractors, but they all involve a judgment. Are we doing more harm than good by extending the scope of this protection to independent contractors? And that's why I would submit to you, and it's interesting, and Nela in their brief had this list of, look at all of these situations where, these scenarios, where we should have some kind of protection by way of a common law right. Virtually all of them are addressed by a statute, whether it's the Commercial Motor Vehicle Safety Act, Sarbanes-Oxley, Dodd-Frank, HIPAA. There's currently whistleblower legislation before Congress called the Aviation Screening Contractor Reform and Accountability Act that's dealing with problems with respect to TSA. That's how these problems should be addressed. That's how they are addressed. And it is consistent with this court's own methodology. In Powell versus American Motors Corp., this court was also asked to recognize a new common law cause of action. The common law cause of action in that case that was being proposed was for loss of parental and filial consortium. And what the court did is it canvassed, as it has, frankly, in all of the wrongful discharge cases, the law of other jurisdictions, because that's how you satisfy yourself. Is this something that's really rooted in the common law, or are we just making this up as we go along? Are we legislating here? And in Powell versus American Motor Code, this court looked at what other states had done with respect to this common law right. And they found that the states were very divided in terms of whether this common law right existed and whether it should be recognized. And what this court said was that given the fact that there is this division among the states with respect to whether this is a cognizable cause of action and the reasons that they give, that's a strong indication that this is a policy issue involving choice of policy considerations, and that is more appropriately the work of the legislature.
I have a quick question for you on the good faith and fair dealing issue. Are you saying that a company and contractor neither owes a duty of good faith and fair dealing in carrying out the contract, or just that it does not prohibit, that duty does not prohibit termination of an independent contractor?
Well, there are the three responses I have to that, Judge. First of all, there's no contract here. I mean, what there was is a purchase order. There was no commitment to use them in the future.
But in the course of their dealing with each other, do they not have to act in good faith, or is that issue before us and we're just dealing with the issue of termination?
That issue has been addressed by courts across the country, and there are two responses. First of all, courts in Missouri and across the United States have held that even if this was a contract to use them for some indefinite term that's terminable at will, a contract that's terminable at will is not governed by the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And part of it
is termination, or
as to termination, okay, in particular, because it undermines the clear intent of the parties. The other line of cases, which again, there are cases in this state, not by this court, and across the country, is that the common law or the covenant of good faith and fair dealing cannot be used to circumvent limitations on the wrongful discharge cause of action. Because if you could do that, then essentially you'd proceed as a contract action and all the limitations that you've placed on the wrongful discharge cause of action disappear. And so those are and again, I would submit to you that that is a consensus. It makes sense. And again, you go back to the issue, whether or not there is in fact, and whether this court will recognize a common law cause of action. Because again, in Powell, when there was a dispute, you said, well, this is a policy issue. How much greater a policy issue is it in this case, where every jurisdiction in the country has rejected this particular cause of action? I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think there are two cases out of the U.S. Supreme Court that are worthy of consideration here. And the Lawson case involving the expansion of Sarbanes-Oxley to independent contractors or employees of independent contractors, where it wasn't clear in the statute, the Supreme Court, as a rationale for covering those employees of independent contractors, said they're the ones in a position to find the fraud. And if we exclude them, then the fraud's going to go unnoticed and will continue. That's an important policy consideration here. The distinction between independent contractor and employee or contract employee is not significant when you're talking about how do we protect the public policy. The other case is the U.S. Supreme Court case saying that independent contractors can pursue claims under Section 1983, a general civil rights statute, that when you read the statute, it opens it up. Sounds like public policy. No one can be punished for expressing and for doing something that's allowed by the Constitution or laws of the United States. Public policy is based on the Constitution or laws of the state of Missouri or the United States. And the Supreme Court in Umbear, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, talked about the similarities between independent contractors and employees in allowing independent contractors to have that same cause of action when they're exercising their free speech rights to complain about illegal, unconstitutional government action. It's the same thing here. There's not been a flood of litigation under 1983 for independent contractors. When in 1985, when Missouri Court of Appeals recognized the cause of action for employees in the Boyle case, there hasn't been a flood of litigation, even though there weren't that many states that were allowing it at that time. And most importantly, it's important litigation. I mean, when you have a company that's violating the law, and the standard for a violation or a reasonable belief in violation, I don't think you have to decide that issue here, but the standard is it has to be a clearly stated, serious matter that's being brought to the attention of the officials within the company. If they can ignore that and get rid of the people who are complaining about this serious misconduct, then the serious misconduct continues, and the employees of Ameren, the employees, the public around Ameren, the environment is going to continue to suffer.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.